Welcome everybody to episode 5, Sustainability for Dummies, what sustainable technology actually means. After the prototype or the dashboard is built and the program ends or runs out of funds, what happens to the technology? How we think about sustaining technology is becoming more complex. Where we might have thought about only one system before, interoperability or the joining up of data and systems requires resourcing, hardware and software infrastructure, storage and human capacity from multiple systems simultaneously. One system has vulnerabilities and that can have an increased impact on the whole system. What do we need to know or be thinking about related to sustainability to help prepare for the future? So why this episode? A part of it is because we wrote an excellent technical infrastructure chapter exactly for this reason. We wanted to help our partners and ourselves weigh the right cloud versus site storage options and understand how to build from millions of data points in the future, when systems currently may only have a few hundred or a few thousand data points today. Knowing what a desire there's to use large volumes of data for algorithms, for machine learning, we wanted to document how we think about building technology to last past the fads. I've got a cracking roundtable of DGOs here with me. So we'll do a quick round and we'll have folks introduce themselves. Usman, would you like to go first?
Sure. Hi, everybody. Hi, Bev. Great to be around. I'm Usman Koneh, Program Manager at DG Development Gateway based in Dakar. And I work on the program called VIFA, Visualizing Insight on Fertilizer for African Agriculture, which project basically addressed the supply, demand, and use of fertilizer data across 8 countries on the continent.
Welcome, Usman. Fernando.
Hi, so I'm Fernando Ferreira. I'm the Director of Software Development at DG. I'm based from Los Angeles, and I've been working at DG for 16 years now. My initial work was in the aid management platform, which is one of our flagship programs that deals with this issue concretely and directly. We've deployed this in 25 countries now, and we've faced a lot of the challenges that we're going to discuss.
Thanks for joining us, Fernando. And finally, Winnie.
Hello, everyone. My name is Winnie Awor. I am a program manager at Development Gateway based in Nairobi. I have worked on 2 main programs. That is the Visualizing Information on Seeds Using Technology in Africa. And the second program is the Tobacco Control Data Initiative, which cuts across 6 countries in the region.
Excellent. Welcome, Winnie, Fernando, and Usman. And of course, I have my producers who are doing the best in the background. We've got Wakini Njogu and Anna Chuter also with us today. So let's dive right in. When we say sustainability, what does that mean in the context of DG's work?
I can kick us off. I think that throughout the years in our work, it's been such a fundamental aspect. We've been working with many, many countries. We've seen many abandoned projects that have been replaced back by paper processes. And we are very keen on trying to identify how we keep the systems running long after we're gone. With the years, what I've seen is that there are big digitalization efforts within the government that cost us to evolve how we approach sustainability. There's a decision to be made about a system, and sometimes it's tempting to go to a one-off solution without looking at the whole context. And we try to avoid and help and guide to make sure that anything that is chosen can be chosen for the longer term. And it takes into account all the aspects of sustainability, from the economics to the institutional knowledge to making sure that the systems are being used.
Yeah, for me, sustainability is what happens long after DG's intervention. We've spent X number of years to build these tools, but what happens when DG goes back home and the partners are left with their tools? Will they be able to maintain the tools that we've developed, and will they actually use them, not just maintain them, but will they use them to inform their day-to-day work? For me, that is sustainability. Over and beyond that is when these partners actually become champions of digitization. So when they are engaging other stakeholders and telling them, hey, this has worked for us, this is what we needed to do, and this is what we are proceeding with for the foreseeable future, it helps create that buy-in with other stakeholders in that specific field or in that specific sector, and actually creates more clients at the end of the day. So when they are able to champion the digitization work, for me, that's sustainability.
For me, it starts with who is the sustainability partner first. Like, who is maintaining everything after the project closed? It's about co-creating with the different partners so that not only they understand the long-term visions, but they also understand the historical context, where we came from and what we've been trying to achieve and what's coming next after the project closes. Then it's about leveraging strategic network. We've been talking a lot about collaboration in the last decades because a lot of the work has been done siloed. But this collaboration also is about leveraging the networks we all have. How are we using our network to support the strategic partnership? And last will be about the technical partners or the sustainability partners equipped to be able to keep up with the work and keep improving the platform long after the program goes. Even if they do not do it by themselves, do they understand the model, the logic enough to be able to carry on?
Yeah, and to add to what Usman was saying is that a lot of the work that goes into the sustainability is assessing the local capacity. The start of the relationships at the start of the program can also inform some of the technologies that you're going to use, because it depends on what the government or the organization is already familiar with. Just understanding that context can help you provide something that even once the project is deployed, we can be sure that there are local resources that can be used. Maybe the government doesn't have them yet, but the private sector may have it. And we go from seeing if the city where we are deploying has it, if the region has it, or some other countries in the region that can provide everything from training to software development to project management.
I think that's such a good point. I think all three of you have touched on this a little bit already when you're talking about how our day-to-day processes functionally changing. Usman talked about rooting in the partner first. And Fernando, I think that last bit is really, really important. Just because you don't have the resources now doesn't mean you can't have them in the future, but you don't know what you don't need if you're not planning for it. It should seem a bit obvious that sustainability is crucial for data-driven development projects, but why does it matter? It's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that goes into building sustainability plans and working with partners to figure out how to make the technology sustainable. Why do it?
One of the things that always comes to mind, the systems that we deploy that are as important as the data. And we need to leave these tools to take a life of their own with the people that are using them. But what could happen is that we deploy an application and the data are not being updated. Then the people stop using the system. The people stop relying on the system. And that impacts in the medium term how people perceive the system and how people use the system, how people tell others about the systems. Sometimes systems are easier to evolve, some others not so much. But in general, having a wider participation on shaping a tool can be key to sustainability. For me, the system is as good as the data it holds. And if you don't have this dimension of making sure that the system is updated, validated, and correct constantly, the risks of people not using your system is very high.
So basically, you're telling me I need a t-shirt that says, anybody can build you a dashboard, but will you use it?
Make it too.
Excellent.
Yeah, please. I think I will need one as well. And on Fernando's point, talking about technology and the system we're building, this is something we do pretty good at DG, is building cost-efficient, scalable, and adaptable systems. Because if it's too complicated how hard to get, how to reach, how to improve or build on, then long after we phase out, it becomes just very hard to move things forward. So ensuring that the solutions continue to serve the purpose and as conditions evolve is also a great part of this. And it also answers the question why this is important. One of the biggest challenges in the development work beyond technology is that valuable systems and data often they lose relevance after the project closes. This is one of the biggest pain points. And I think being able to face that challenge right away is definitely important. And it's not only about tech. It's also about the surrounding. Do we have enough standard operation procedure for the team to know how to go about data collection, for example? Are we training the team so that they can do some of the small configurations by themselves? The partners should not wait until the program ends before they get their hands dirty. They need to be involved. And this goes beyond human-centered design workshop. It's on the day-to-day, how do we manipulate data? How do we configure the dashboard? How do we configure the systems? How do we do the testing? It's also very crucial.
Yeah, it's actually been said in data-driven development projects, the data is dynamic. It's not static. You just don't develop the dashboard and leave it as such. So in the programs that we are working in, for example, you anticipate data to be released every 2 years. When it comes in, what do you expect people to do with these platforms? Will the platform hold this data? Does it accept it as it is? If it comes in a different format, how can the platform adapt to take on this specific data? Because again, we are targeting policy making or any form of decision making, right? If a strategic plan was developed 5 years back and that was based on the data that was available then, the data has significantly changed. Can the system take on this data and can it update as needed? So that again, now when you want to build a strategic plan for the next 5 years, you have the data that you need. And to Fernando's point, you know, if you are not going to be updating these platforms, no one is going to use them. If the data that I now need for my strategic plan is the same data that I had 5 years ago, how is that relevant to me? So data is ever changing. Data is dynamic and the contexts keep changing. Sometimes we build a tool, but because the needs for which it was built are evolving, is the tool able to evolve in some way or adapt in some way to the new context? That is the only way that we ensure the sustainability in this project.
I love that. It's the idea that data is dynamic and the systems are too. None of these things exist in a silo. So how do we think about the people? How do we think about the resources? How do we think about the systems and the data involved? So Winnie, I want to stay with you for a second because we've talked so far at an overarching level about what sustainability means and why it matters. But how has that actually manifested in specific programs? Could you talk a little bit about the experience you had with the Seeds program to SciVista? What kind of strategies were implemented and what were some of the key lessons learned about setting up that particular technology to be sustainable?
So with that specific program, there are different tools to be developed. And what we did was we staggered the release of these tools such that with the first data collection tool, the team had a chance to be trained on how to use these specific tools. And the beauty is we did not train the researchers directly. We trained the TASAI team first. After that, they took ownership of those tools and then they trained their researchers. So that was one of the strategies, just having a staggered approach so that even when the data collection tools had a hiccup at any given point, they had enough time to test it. And then this could be raised with us and we could see how to update it accordingly. In as much as we will stagger the process, because I think that is the way to go, we need to make sure that the last tool is developed at least 6 months before the program closure. That way the team has enough time to understand the kinks of it all. One of the other lessons that should be shared with other programs is the conversation around the costs of these tools. And, you know, if it's just the hardware, how much does that cost? If it's servers, how much would it cost to maintain them throughout the year? If it's technical assistance, how much might that potentially cost? Because sometimes we would think that, you know, once you've built it and people have used it and it's all systems go, there's some hidden costs that you might not foresee. A year into using the tool and the partners start really feeling the pinch as to, oh, there's more to this kind of support that might be needed. So looking at that technical capacity and planning way in advance on how much that would cost, that is also a lesson that we learned.
And just for anybody who's listening, we'll have a link to the TASAI VISTA program in the notes if you want to learn a little bit more about what kinds of dashboards we built there. But I think that it's easy to say it's expensive or it's cheap, but what does that mean? And breaking that down by actually visualizing, like building blocks, like what is going to go into that? Is it this particular kind of software package? Is it a different kind? Is it an on-site server versus something else? Those are the kinds of nuances that are not super fun and sexy to talk about, but are 100% about what lead to various technologies being sustainable. Winnie, you've kicked us off, but before we get to Fernando, I want to jump to Usman because you're currently in it. You're in the thick of figuring out sustainability with the fertilizer program with VIFA. So Usman, can you talk to us a little bit? What does that look like so far for you as you get close to closing the program?
Yeah, right in the middle. So three main things. Let's say that, you know, in our case, we are clear that our sustainability partner is taking full ownership. And that tells us that they are more likely to maintain and expand the initiative long term. The second thing will be ongoing support and training are essential to overcome those initial resistance and ensuring that the systems stay relevant. There's one last thing that we've not mentioned enough, though. It's money. You may want to keep this forever. You may want to build to expand, but you will not go very far because it can be costly. Collecting data, the more granular you go, the wider you go, the more it costs you. So in our case, we have been supporting and working with our partner on a long-term strategy development beyond tech, looking at how can we position this initiative to enhance fundraising at different level. And we are approaching it not only from the development partner side, which tends to be plan A, but also from private sector, which is kind of innovative because private sector doesn't invest in something that's not relevant. So they have to see the value first. And we've been doing some of this work in Nigeria, for example, where they've been investing to help collect some nuanced data and for the fertilizer project, but also in Francophone countries, we've been working with private sector to have them support and sponsor some technical working group. And that reflection is still ongoing because we want to make sure that we are looking at it from the continental level. The strategy or the approach in one country might not be, you know, relevant for others. So we are taking it at another level, connecting with private sector at a continental level, mapping out the needs, looking at the untapped markets where they want to have more visibility and position this initiative to be able to fill that gap, but also help different countries to better report, get data, and connect to the Nairobi 10-year action plan, but most importantly, to localize the overall strategy, which obviously has to be informed by data. So it's a kind of like 360 views, but I would like to end with that last one. Finance is very important, and you need to be able to strategically position whatever initiative you have for it to be sustainable.
Perfect. Thanks for walking us through that, Usman. That's really helpful. Fernando, you've got the big fish because not only as director of software do you get to see all of the startup of all of our programs, but in particular, we've seen the growth of aid management platforms over time. So can you talk a little bit about what that has looked like and how our thinking has evolved about specific strategies we use?
Absolutely. So as I was preparing for the podcast, I was going a bit on a retrospective of AMB. And we've seen the meaning of sustainability evolve quite a bit in the last 16 years or so. From having our systems running in a box under the desk, being connected directly by the officers, to deploying things in cloud services and automated infrastructure, or a government that already has a full managed enterprise level cloud service. We've seen it all. For me, the challenge is rarely the technology, but it's the sustainability. And it goes back to what Usman and Winnie were saying. It sometimes comes to the finances of it. How you can plan for the costs of running this tool and be resilient to the changes in the landscape of technology and the governments. Our strategies are to maximize this. There's no perfect solution for it, but there are things that you can do and put in place to improve your odds of maintaining this. And we've seen it all in the AMP program, where in that case, we work exclusively with governments, and that has its own challenges. Governments sometimes change priorities. The employee turnover can be pretty high. So how do you make sure that you have everything in place so it can improve the odds of the tool or the platform being run in the long term? It's pretty complex and it's changing. AMP is singularly challenged that to be very valuable, it has to hold many, many years of information. So you need to make sure that the data is being updated, that the user interfaces used to update the data are consistent, easy to use. You need to help people see the value on the platform so they will embrace it. And we had a very good experience with governments embracing the tool and using it for their financial planning and so on. And it can be a learning experience to see how people use our tool. When we come back to a country after a few years and they tell us that they are still using the platform and that they found new applications for it, like new ways of using, new use cases that they report on that we didn't think about. Going into a bigger project that we're working right now for the Ministry of Agriculture in Ethiopia, or a LIFE project, I think that this is one of those projects that have benefited from our approach to sustainability. Because one of the big things that we had to do there is understanding the context. What are the systems that were going to be integrated? Just to summarize what the Alive project is, it's building a livestock information system for the government of Ethiopia that collates data from five other systems. Sometimes we go to institutions or governments and we find these systems that have some documentation that was written 5 years ago that we don't know how valid it is. And in software platforms, 5 years, it's a long time. And things can get deprecated fast. So what we did there was to go through each of these systems, see if we understood what the documentation was, who the users were, how it's being used, and how we can take them further. But our platform in that case is going to be dependent on the data entry of these other systems. So we needed to look at these other systems and see how we could sustain those, all the sustainability in our bigger system.
I think that's such a great place to end on, Fernando, regarding sort of what we've done in particular projects. If we really want to underscore what we really think about and what really matters around sustainability and technology, is that trust needs to be built over time, which means you've got to be thinking about consistency. When we talk about the importance of deciding between hardware and software, it's not because we want to turn you into a software engineer, which is cool. You can. Software engineering is awesome. And our software engineers at DG are amazing. But we're trying to help our partners think through what will it take to keep the dashboard online over time. So that means it's a software question, it's a capacity question, it's a resource question. Why this matters is because if you go to a dashboard for a critical service and the website is down, how many more times will you visit that website before you stop coming back? So when we think about sustainability and we think about why it matters, why it's worth the time and the effort and the crying over how to figure out how to make it work, is that it's about building trust over time. You want your citizens to keep coming back, or your users to keep coming back to use it. And you want your decision makers to keep using that data and relying on that data to drive evidence-based decisions. You guys have already done a really good job of pointing out how we work with partners at every stage, about why we think about sustainability, about why it matters, about what that means for specific programs. But if you had to give one piece of advice, the one thing that really crystallizes for you how partners are a non-negotiable and essential piece of sustainable tech, what would that be? And Usman, I wouldn't start with you.
Working with local partners who have been on the ground for years helps build credibility and trust, because it's usually a small ecosystem. They all know each other. Most of the time, they have the same data providers, and most of the time, the users will also be in that cycle. So these partnerships not only provide valuable context, but also increase confidence in the data. This helps open doors to broader opportunities for collaboration. The second thing is about how do we maximize the resources. Data collection, I put it, mostly at the granular level can be very costly. And most of the time, governments are often the biggest data owners. Collaborating with them ensure access to essential data while reducing cost, because it can be very expensive and time-consuming. And as I put it previously, engaging with other stakeholders such as like private sector, etc., can help also secure some funding and resources to sustain data validation activities and data collections as well activities.
Winnie, what do you think?
Actually, it goes down to just the trust that we need to build with these stakeholders. And I'll give you the example of now the tobacco control program that I have been part of. Because tobacco control is quite sensitive, they need to vet you properly to find out, are you working for the tobacco industry or are you actually pro-tobacco control? That's number one. Number two, what is the angle that you're coming with? Is it some sort of advocacy that they are already working on that might potentially overlap with yours? Or are you a neutral field altogether? So that trust, we had to build that over time, and it needed a lot of co-creation, collaboration for them to see the value that we were bringing to the table. And at the end of the day, what we found out was there was quite a bit of tobacco control data, but there was a lot of red tape around it. And people would not share if they do not trust you. But now, even before a report is published, they will come and tell you, hey, this is going to be published in the next few days. How can we incorporate it in the dashboard? So they are having that ownership of the dashboard because of the trust that you have built with them. And some of them would actually come back to us and say, hey, we appreciate the process. You have made us feel like we are part and parcel. So it's through that building of trust that people now come up to us and share the data willingly. Even government themselves have that ownership, and they are the ones who'll fight for it. They want it signed by their own government. They'll go to whoever needs to sign it and champion it and say, this is why we need to sign this report. We have been part of the process. So that co-creation cannot be overemphasized. It goes a long way in building trust.
Fernando, our OG, one thing.
I've been thinking about this. Sustainability is pretty complex, so I wouldn't dare to just give one advice. But I have one piece of advice that I think it's important. Sometimes when an organization or a government has a problem, they can be tempted by an ad hoc solution that will provide a quick answer to the question. But those platforms tend to be a mirage. They will solve a problem in the short term, but have longer consequences in the medium and long term. Take the time to decide on a platform, think about sustainability, review your risks, and fold in and understand the context before making a decision. That would be my small piece of advice.
Thank you, Usman. Thank you, Fernando. Thank you, Winnie. As my computer reminds me, the clock unfortunately has to keep ticking. This brings us to the end of this special season on interoperability. Thank you for rocking with us and rolling with us. If you came in and you knew what interoperability was, you get a gold star. If you came in and learned along the way what that means and how that manifests, you know, extra gold stars for you. It's not an easy subject, but a really critical one that's going to keep coming up in everything from elections to agriculture. If this was your first episode, you can catch up on the earlier episodes and read our latest white paper on interoperability. Please click the link in the bio. This episode was produced by Wakini Njoku, Anna Chuta, and me, Beverly Hatrimbu. It was edited by Joseph Wagner and Wakini Njoku. The music was provided by Mark D. Hatcher.